Welcome back, everyone, and thank you for downloading episode 154 of the Golf Unfiltered podcast. I'm your host, as always, Adam from golfunfiltered.com. You can find me on Twitter at golfunfiltered, and you can send me an email, golfunfiltered@gmail.com. The golf ball distance debate is the hot topic in the last couple of weeks, and we bring back Mr. Mike Statura from Golf Digest for the third time to talk a little bit about not only the USGA annual distance report, but also about the article that he and his colleague E. Michael Johnson wrote on Golf World, addressing some of the more popular debate questions or arguments for and against whether or not we should roll back the golf ball. Mike and I talk about a lot of things in this episode that I think you're going to enjoy. We also talk about some of the more interesting questions that have come up regarding golf ball distance, and of course Mike offers some very insightful responses as well as his experience with the data that he's seen and the people he's spoken to. And so this is a great episode for those of you interested in the topic, and these days if you're a golfer you're probably interested in it. So just a couple quick shout outs first to our friends over at the Hackers Paradise, if you're listening to this on the THP Radio app, as well as to our friends over at Cleveland and Srixon. As you guys know, I am playing their equipment this year, and I am very excited to finally get out and play some golf. The temperature is finally turned that corner, and it's getting warmer. So also a quick reminder to go out to our Patreon page and offer some support to the show if you so feel like that's something you'd like to do. And thanks to all those of you that who have already done that. So that's enough of that. Sit back and relax. Here is Mr. Mike Statura from Golf Digest. Enjoy. Listeners, I'm here with Mr. Mike Statura again from Golf Digest. And Mike, we were just talking a little bit ago. You've had an extremely busy week, I imagine, with all this golf ball distance stuff.
Yeah, obviously, Adam, it's been a sort of hinted at by the leaders of both the RNA and the USGA that there was going to be this report, in which we obviously knew. This is the timing that the distance report has come out the previous 2 years, and so we were sort of looking for it maybe as much as 3 or 4 weeks ago, and given some of the statements from both Mike Davis of the USGA and Martin Slumbers of the RNA, there were clearly things in this, you know, what is basically an update type of report. I mean, the statistics that are in this report are not state secrets or hard to find out. In fact, I had all the statistics that were going to be in the report for a month, month and a half. Anybody can find them. And, you know, so I think it was just more wondering what the exact tone of this annual distance report would be. And, you know, you didn't have to read too deeply between the lines to kind of get that the sense that the ruling bodies now, at least officially on paper, have indicated that distance is, while not a problem, is an issue that they're concerned about, okay? And they're using language like, we want to engage in a thoughtful conversation, and there are some unusual numbers that they're seeing in the monitoring of the tours over 2017. So it's a different tone than that sort of perfunctory report has taken in the previous two editions. So yeah, it was a pretty. I knew it was the logic of it coming out on Monday was not lost on me. I mean, obviously, it comes out the day after a tour event where the field average was 305.9 yards. So
right.
That subtlety wasn't lost on me, and kind of got my advanced copy at 7 o'clock in the morning and got to work on it. And there's been a fair amount of industry reaction going forward, a lot of discussions. I think the USGA and RNA I don't know if they anticipated the reactions they were going to get. I think they were trying to navigate, maybe shape the tone of the conversation a little bit before the actual document came out. But I think this is probably much, much bigger than they could have anticipated in terms of controlling the message the way they would want to.
Which is kind of surprising to me because this is something that we've been talking about for a while. I mean, this is the third time you've been on this podcast, and you and I have at least touched on the topic of golf ball distance every episode, I think. And, you know, it has been, you were absolutely right, it has been quite the response to this report. And I think everyone was just kind of waiting for them to say something. And the report that we're referring to, listeners, is the their USGA's annual distance report. And it's a very thorough report. I mean, it's not just a few data points. There's a ton of data. It's very well done, and there's just a lot of different metrics that are within it. And you've obviously, Mike, as you mentioned, you had it prior to publication. You had the chance to kind of dig into the statistics. What were some of the bigger takeaways that you, as someone who read it for the first time, what were some of the biggest takeaways that you got out of the report?
Well, I think there were some things that were fairly similar from past years' reports. I mean, I think one of the things that they like to highlight is there a bigger gap between the longest drivers and the shortest drivers, and that gap seems to be basically the same. Now, where they are on the ladder is a different position than they were, but certainly when you see across the seven professional tours that they track, okay, they track the PGA Tour, PGA Tour Champions, Web.com, European Tour, Japan Tour, the Ladies European Tour, and the LPGA, across those seven tours to see an average increase of 3 yards, while, again, to the common golfer, 3 yards is like nothing. You wouldn't know that if you catalog the 1,000 rounds of your typical average golfers. It's well within the noise, but that 3 yard jump is coming on the heels of basically 14 years of 0.2 to 0.4 yard increases on an average annual basis. I mean, obviously there's been a lot of flexibility and movement and variability in the numbers across multiple tours. So it's not like it's a straight line up, but essentially what you see is an unusual 1 year jump. And that's surprising. I think what was most surprising to me is that these jumps have occurred and the USGA and the RNA have not sort of overreacted to a 1 year jump in the past. This time, I'm not saying they overreacted, but this time it seemed they went to DEFCON 1 pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, one of the biggest questions I had reading the report and seeing the response from the governing bodies was exactly what you just pointed out, was all of a sudden their eyebrows raise at this data point that's between 2016 and 2017. And for me, someone who admittedly is in the area of, yeah, there's probably something going on here that we need to address from a distance perspective, what's more mind-boggling in my mind, I guess, is the fact that trend-wise, even with all the technological advancements and what have you for the last however many years, the ball's going farther. Like no one is disagreeing with that as a whole, but now suddenly a single data point from 2016 to 2017, to your point, suddenly people are taking notice. Did that rub you in a weird way?
Not in a weird way, because I mean, literally, I live in these stats every year, every week, trying to understand where the numbers are going and trying honestly to get past the anecdotal, because there is a huge anecdotal bias in this debate. And we can argue forever that guys can hit it 350 whenever they want to hit it 350 with ease. if that were true, we wouldn't have seen, this jump would have happened in 2017. We would have been seeing it constantly over time. And really, when you look at the numbers, the things like percentage of 320-yard drives or correlation between driving distance and rank on the money list, or lots of ins and outs. There was not sort of this indication of anything abnormal. You did see in 2017 essentially a 40% jump in the number of 320-yard drives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's again, if you're any kind, that is weird. Okay,
yeah, it is.
Now there are reasons behind that. Okay, there are things going on that affect those numbers. Okay, you have a dramatic difference in venue and weather conditions for three of the four major championships. That actually had an impact on what the PGA Tour driving distance average was. So there are things that you can look at that say, well, I know we have the sense of moving up in a straight line, but mm-hmm. if you look across all tours, the numbers are pretty clear that from 2003 to 2016, the rate of increase annually in driving distance across all tours was basically a third of a yard.
Mm.
Now, obviously, that means that over 14 years, there's 5 to 6 yards increase. And at some point, you're going to say, well, if that line keeps going up, then in 25 years, we're going to have driving distance averages that are over 300 yards. Well, mm-hmm. we're not quite 25 years down the road, but we're 15 years since the Joint Statement of Principles was signed, when the ruling body said, okay, no more significant gains in distance. And that's a key phrase, significant gains. If you look at the trend line and say, okay, well, yeah, where we are now compared to where we were when you signed the Joint Statement, that's significant in some fashion. But how we got there over time was not anywhere near the rate of increase that we saw in the decade leading up to the Joint Statement of Principles.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's your sort of calculus or understanding, okay, what happened from 1993 to 2002, you saw essentially 20 yards of growth on the PGA Tour in driving distance in a very short period of time. You haven't had another 20 yards of driving distance growth in the PGA Tour driving distance average in the ensuing 15 years. It's I think maybe one quarter the rate of growth in the last 15 years since the Joint Statement went into effect, compared to the 10 years leading into the Joint Statement. So with that in mind, you're saying, well, okay, it's not a significant increase. It's much less the level of increase that caused us to be concerned back in 2002 and 3 when we got together on the Joint Statement. So, okay, yeah, it's going farther, and we see lots of players hitting 350-yard or 400-yard drives, but the numbers that we are basing our decision on, they're not reflecting that. And we've certainly done tons of studies to show, well, okay, are we getting good numbers? Are we getting a driver being hit most of the time when we're using those numbers to calculate driving distance? The USGA is doing that research to sort of confirm this position that, yes, it's been a slow creep, and it seems we're in control. I mean, I go back to the old Dick Ruggie line as he was walking out the door, about distance, and where he said, hey, you may not like the station that the train is in right now, but the train is not leaving the station.
Yeah.
And that's a fair debate. I mean, you may want driving distance to go back to 1990, and or 1995, or pick a year. Obviously, we're not there, but I think what happened in 2017 has made the ruling bodies, who quite honestly are not eager to get into this fight, but they're very protective about the integrity of the game and that balancing of the skills that they think are required to be an elite player, an excellent player, what they view as what a champion golfer should be. And if one of those skills is being overly rewarded, or that skill requirement is being diminished, that's what is going to make them sit up and take notice. So I don't know exactly if you could say, oh, well, there was plenty of evidence that this was happening and they didn't do anything. I think they, rightly or wrongly, are very focused on looking at the numbers in front of them, and there really wasn't anything in the numbers that said we were seeing some sort of monumental shift in the way that we saw a monumental shift in the mid and late 90s and early 2000s.
You know, it's funny too, the point that you make about them wanting to protect the integrity of the game and what a champion should look like. I mean, I don't see the governing bodies as a group of folks that would pay such close attention to an anchored putter and then look the other way when there's just talk about golf ball distance off the tee. And so I certainly take your point. In the days that followed the release of your initial summary of the report, you and your colleague E. Michael Johnson over at Golf Digest and for Golf World wrote a great article kind of addressing some of the more frequently asked questions, I guess you could say, or some of the more popular arguments to and against the golf ball distance debate. And one of the questions that I really liked and that I'm glad you included, and you even just touched on this a little bit ago, was we are seeing golf balls on TV flying a lot further in these pro events. I mean, you even point out that in last year there was a substantial jump in 400-yard drives to around 80, when the previous year was much less than that. Now, obviously, there's playing conditions, there's climate, there's elevation, all of those things. But at the end of the day, television viewers might possibly have their opinion or perception skewed by that, couldn't they?
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, you got to remember that every week there's, in a normal week, there's 156 players in the field, and you're seeing maybe 10 or 12 or 15 of them on a broadcast, and you're seeing the best, the ones who are playing the best, and you're not seeing, you know, Gavin Green hitting at 279
right
last week when the field average was 305. So, I mean, I think that's been a big point of emphasis with the USGA's technical team in trying to, you know, essentially get past the anecdotal aspect of this, because, you know, whether it was anchored putting or spring-like effect or grooves, the perceptions were sometimes dictating the argument or dictating the debate, and I'm going to tell you, the guys at the research and technical center at the USGA are pretty dispassionate about this. What they are passionate about is doing the research. You know, they are into the work. They don't have an agenda. They're not cheering for one side or the other, but they are. It's a science experiment, okay? Mm-hmm. And when something strange happens in a science experiment, you're trying to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this distance thing has been extremely studied. You know, you could make the argument that mistakes were made along the way when it came to allowing drivers with spring-like faces, that mistakes were made back in the early 1970s when they allowed solid court golf balls. Mistakes were made when they allowed driver size to be 460 cc's and moment of inertia to be 5900 with a 100 point tolerance. You know, you could say that all those were mistakes, and if you hadn't made those mistakes, if you had been firm, maybe we wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not saying the place that we would be would necessarily be a better place. And I think that's kind of the calculus that the people technically in charge of making the rules have to sort of figure out how to navigate. But you know, I think that given that all those things were allowed to happen, or you know, certainly allowing a solid core ball in the 70s was a great idea because it really made the game much more affordable,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. Golf balls got much cheaper to make. Now, what was lost in that decision was somebody could make a golf ball that spun like a wound ball on short shots, wound a lot of ball, and performed like a top flight two-piece ball on driver and long shots. And that's one reason why we're here. But I also think that there are a lot of competing factors. I really am not convinced at this point that it is specifically a golf ball problem. I think the actual contributions of the driver and how players have come to learn to use the driver are really making it a different sort of event at Impact. And you know, you can I've seen like three or four tour players tweet in the last few days that, you know, I hit my 7-iron today the same way I hit my 7-iron when I was in college,
right,
and the distance the same. Now, those guys that are saying that are in their 30s.
Right, right.
Okay, the guys who are in their 20s, I mean, I certainly saw Justin Thomas hit gap wedge over the green in the playoff from 160 yards. Now, again, we get all loopy when we see that, but it's 160 yards, minus 15% for elevation downhill, jacked up in mm-hmm. a playoff. So
yeah, well, it's just that too. I mean, we go off of what we see on television based on whatever graphics being shown and what the commentators tell us is being hit, which, you know, I mean, that's probably not always 100% accurate. And as you just pointed out, there's other metrics and variables involved. And I think most people understand that, but one of the things that constantly comes up on social and other places whenever anybody talks about this debate is, you know, the pros and the amateurs have to play the same thing. And honestly, Mike, I just don't understand, and I'll give credit where credit's due. A former colleague of yours, Luke Kerdanine, actually said this pretty well not too long ago. He said, "I don't understand why it's so hard for people to grasp the concept of bifurcation." And you know, I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I mean, is this a time when maybe if we were to do anything, obviously the USGA and the RNA are going to go back and they're going to look at stuff. Could we be inching closer to an official bifurcation, or is that just completely, you know, off the table?
You know, I don't think anything's off the table right now. I mean, you know, I think everything from rolling us back to persimmon and blotta to doing nothing is on the table.
Well, Linksole is coming out with persimmon these days.
Well, there you go. So somebody's already ahead of the curve. But I think the issue of bifurcation is sort of inextricably tied to one of the key tenets of the joint statement of principles. Okay, so when, you know, people forget in the time that the joint statement of principles came out, it was at a time when a lot of crazy things were happening. Spring-like effect was really just starting to happen. The USGA and RNA were disagreeing on what the limit should be. The RNA was going to allow it, allow a higher COR than the USGA was. Club companies were making RNA conforming clubs and USGA conforming clubs. Some companies, Callaway most notably, were introducing clubs that would not conform to any rule for spring-like effect. So it was in that environment that the organization said, listen, we need to stand together, figure out what we think is important, and come out with a statement so that everybody knows what we think about the rules and where distance is going and other aspects. And I think right in that rule is, or in that statement, in the very, you know, first few paragraphs of that statement, is the RNA and the USGA continue to believe that the retention of a single set of rules for all players of the game, irrespective of ability, is one of golf's greatest strengths. The RNA and USGA regard the prospect of having permanent, separate rules for elite competition as undesirable and have no current plans to create separate equipment rules for highly skilled players. Mm. That's written in stone. Mm-hmm. So then we fast forward to the Groove situation, and clearly there was this opening of the door for bifurcation, even though no one at the USGA or an RNA would even deign to admit that that was happening. And I think we can say that they are more agreeable to that idea, and yet they have not indicated in any way that that moving to two separate sort of set of guidelines or equipment specifications. Mm-hmm. You know, the main objection is it's a simpler game if we all play by the same rule. Mm-hmm. And we all use equipment. It's a better industry if it works out that way. The other problem is bifurcation is a simple concept that is wickedly difficult to enact, and especially so if you're going to single one piece of equipment to focus that bifurcation on. So I think that's been the holdup. I do think that bifurcation is probably more on the table because, you know, even in the distance report, you see here's what we're seeing the best players in the world do. Here's this gap that's developing with driving distance with the best players in the world. And oh, by the way, here's what we've seen happen with our admittedly very limited, but not so limited that we're not going to put it in this report. Here's what's happening to average golfer distance. Mm-hmm. And average golfer distance is not threatening any unusual increases of 8 yards over a 20-yard, 21-year span is nice, but it's not a threat to the game. And I think the disparity between what average golfers do and what elite golfers do is probably widening, but we have to figure out what that definition of elite golfer is. And, you know, there's another side of me that says, if you bifurcate, if you decide that wherever you draw the line, that there is going to be this sort of restrictive type of equipment, you know, either a golf ball change or kind of like a Major League Baseball wooden bat versus aluminum bat, mm-hmm, type of change. If that happens, are we perhaps seeing a future where it's not just an elite golfer change, but it's certain types of golfers on certain types of clubs and courses and state golf associations. And there comes a point when, you know, you sort of lose the rhythm, lose the focus, and all of a sudden, well, which rules are we playing today? And
right.
Oh, your course uses the throwback ball. Oh, well, I don't have any throwback balls.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, we have them here. So it's just it's fine if you know if you can get over this whatever period that we have to go through to get to that period.
Right.
But I think. And you know, weirdly silent in all this debate about whether we should have two sets of rules is the LPGA Tour, who
good point
has you know right they've seen some distance gains, but they haven't seen anything crazy. And yeah, there are plenty women on the LPGA Tour who can hit a drive 300 yards on occasion. I mean, given the right circumstances, but they're not obsolete in golf courses. So I think if the LPGA Tour is in a position where we're elite players, so we're going to roll back because all elite players are, or oh well, you're not important enough to get to have your clubs and balls rolled back.
Right.
You know, they become sort of second class citizens in all this. That's probably, we're probably not globally in a good place to do that, to make that move.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's the problem with bifurcation is its simplicity. It's very seductive as a solution when in practice, we don't even know where to draw the line because the national championships are essentially a qualifying process that is based on your handicap, which is achieved and determined with what kind of equipment. Is it a handicap has to be posted with the equipment that you're going to use in this elite level competition. Well, how do we do that?
Right.
So then that sounds to me like, well, why would we bifurcate? Why wouldn't we just roll it back for everybody? And oh yeah, you Mr. Average golfer with your 200 yard drive, have some fun as you just lose another 15 yards. So it's messy. I'd like the idea that Major League Baseball players don't use aluminum bats for the simple reason that they would probably kill 43 pitchers a year.
Right. You don't want to give Bryce Harper a metal bat. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So and Bryce Harper, 15 years ago, was he using an aluminum bat? Of course he was.
Right.
And he had to make the transition because that's the rules when you're at the elite level. I think the that transition, it's obviously made. There are hundreds of college players who go on to Major League Baseball careers who didn't hit a wooden bat until they got into A ball or C ball or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you could make the case that maybe that's the solution, okay, that
mm-hmm.
When you get to the PGA Tour, or when you get to the Web.com Tour, or wherever the line is, all of a sudden your driver is 175 cc's and must be made of steel, and you have to have a 100 gram shaft.
Yeah, and then it just becomes more difficult, following that line of logic, then perhaps even bifurcation. So, you know, it's a strong point, Mike, and you know, one that that I think people like myself certainly have to understand that making a recommendation or a proposal to bifurcate, that's fine in words, but in actual implementation could be a lot more difficult. And I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Mike, but along with some of the arguments that you and E. Michael Johnson outlined in your article, there are many more that go out there that, and believe me, Mike, I've heard some pretty outlandish arguments one way or the other, as I'm sure you have too. And I don't want to put you on the spot, and I don't want to, be controversial with this, but one of those arguments, and I just want to get your take on it, is this suggestion that perhaps because there are not officials at every event that in the moment measure specifications and ensure that golf clubs are conforming, that perhaps some players are playing with quote unquote juiced clubs. Have you heard anything of that nature, and or is that just completely off the wall?
I wouldn't say it's completely off the wall. I think it's tragic that the PGA Tour has essentially removed the CT machine and not made it standard practice that every driver is tested. I think the reason they've done it, and it's not been stated publicly, but originally the reason they removed them is because nobody was using them. Well, obviously nobody was using them because they didn't have to. The problem, obviously, from a PR standpoint, is golfers are generally regarded as the most honest competitors in all of professional sport. Their image is why they're successful, not just as competitors, but the PGA Tour is successful because its athletes are never in trouble. Its game is a very positive game. And it's a great sell for corporate. If you interject this possibility of guys using hot equipment by having it tested at every event, you maybe damage the brand. And nothing can damage the brand if you don't put things in place that might damage it. In other words, if you don't risk anything, then you're kind of free and clear. I don't think any I don't think any equipment company wants to put themselves in a situation where they are introducing product that is not made to a tolerance level that gets them in trouble. That said, is it theoretically possible? I think it's certainly possible, and I think if the fact that you and I are talking about it as being possible does not spur the PGA Tour to investigate the problem, not just in a random way, but in a, okay, starting June 1st for all eternity, every Thursday morning, every driver is being tested of everybody in the field, and to do it again next week and the week after that and every week, and that's just how we do it. I don't even understand why it's not part of the matrix, because at NASCAR nobody is offended that my car has to go through inspection because everybody's car has to go through inspection. And I covered NASCAR 30 years ago, and it's a tedious element that's part of the week, and it should be a tedious element that's part of the PGA Tour week. I know that the USGA routinely spot checks tour vans. That's not necessarily a definitive case that's being made. There are ways to sort of get around that if that's what you want to do. I don't believe that it's happening, but I certainly recognize the possibility that it could be happening, and in that recognition, if I'm at the PGA Tour, I don't understand why I wouldn't want to do everything I could to put that rumor to rest.
I agree that I also don't think it's happening. But to your point, you know, the fact that we don't check or at least have a method in place to assure us 100% that, no, this isn't happening and this is the proof why we know it isn't. It's a risk point and something that you point out quite well. And certainly if we go so far or if the tour goes so far as to implement that, then that in a way is kind of admitting that maybe there is a problem here insofar as our measurement system and our checks and balances. So interesting stuff. I wanted to get your take on that, and I appreciate you sharing it. And listeners, we're talking to Mr. Mike Statura again from Golf Digest. Mike, I always appreciate your willingness to lend your time, and I know it's late by you. Go get some rest, and if anything else comes up, we'll certainly bring you back on.
I'd love to do it. Thanks, Alan. This was fun.